Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This works. Yep. Good. So last time we talked about building processors to implement Y86. So one thing we needed is we needed the physical components that would hold the state of our program. So we had some registers. We needed a program counter to know what's the instruction we're currently executing. We needed some registers to hold the condition codes. In our case, we're going to keep the sign flag and the zero flag. We also needed all the values of the program registers, the ones you refer to in assembly, like RAX, RBX, all the way up to R14. So we have what we call the register file, which held all those values. And we also had values in memory, like the instructions themselves, and whatever RM move Q and MR move Q are going to access. And that's in what we call the data memory. And our version of all these components worked in this way, where we had a clock cycle, and anything that we were reading happened during the clock cycle. And all the writes happened at this rising edge of this global clock signal. That was our convention. That all of our components, they do all the writes at that rising edge, and everything in the middle, we can read, we can compute values, and we just set things up to do the write. In addition to these state components, we needed a way to make decisions, like we want to do something different for a knock than a jump. So we need some way in hardware of representing this decision. And our primary component for that was a MUX, which is basically a controllable switch. We have a control signal which selects one of the inputs, and it connects that input to the output. And based on this, we're building a single cycle processor. So all the processors we've been talking about execute one instruction per cycle. No more, no less. So the cycle starts with the rising edge of the clock when we write into our program counter. And based on that, we end up computing all the values for the instruction during that cycle, doing all our reads, all our computation during that cycle. And at the end of the cycle, we have all our values ready to write. We have our new program counter. If we're writing to memory, we have the value to send to memory. If we're writing to the register file, we have the values of the new of the registers that are updated. Those are all ready by the end of the clock cycle, and at that rising edge, all the writes for that instruction are going to happen all at once. That's how all the processors we've been designing work so far. So any questions about how these components work, our general processor design, how the timing works out? Or we move on. So last time when we finished up, we were looking at implementing these instructions in a CPU. I believe we finished, we had R move Q. For R move Q, we wanted to take read from RA, which is gonna use this source say port in the register file. We want to take this value, put it in our destination. For IR move Q, we want to take instead the immediate value and put it in our destination. So we have this MUX to choose between those two options. And then we have MR move Q. So for MR move Q, we're going to have to do access the actual data memory. So one thing we need to do is we need to actually send an address into the data memory so it knows where to read from. And if we look at the instruction carefully, that address is the displacement, which is the same thing as the immediate, plus the value of the register RB. So we send register number B into our register file, we get out its value. We add those two together, and that's our address we want to read from. We put an address into our data memory, and sometime in the same cycle, it's going to output that value. We want to select that value and write it to a register. But we need to write to the right register. And if we look at this instruction, that register is RA, not RB. And because of that, we need to actually choose that sometimes for this instruction, we're going to send RA. And for all the other instructions, we're going to send RB. So we need to add a mux to make that choice to send the register number from the correct part of the instruction, whatever number is here for MRMoveQ. But for all these other instructions, we want to send the register number in the RB area of the instruction memory's output. And we had one final thing we need to take care of in this processor, and that's that we need to increment the PC. And for RRMoveQ, our instruction is 2 bytes, and right after this instruction, let's say we have RRMoveQ followed by an IRMoveQ, then if that's in our assembly, then our machine code is going to have the 3 from the IRMoveQ right here, followed by the 0, followed by the F, followed by whatever the register number is. Let's say we're writing into R8, and then we would have 8 here, followed by the actual value we're writing. So if we had 0x123, we'd have 2, 3, the byte 2, 3, then the byte 0, 1, then a bunch of 0 bytes, and so on. And that's what's in memory. And we want to set, in this case, the program counter was pointing here. We want to advance it by 1, 2 bytes to here. And that's going to be this option for RRMoveQ. And this and for everything else, the instruction is 10 bytes, so our next opcode goes here. So you want to advance by 10. Okay. We have that extra mux to make that decision. Is our instruction 2 bytes or 10 bytes? So any questions on anything here? So let's complete all our move instructions and add the one we were missing so far, which is moving from a register into memory. So this, unlike all the others, we're not writing to a register here, we're writing to memory and not changing any registers. So here's where we started, and we went to add that instruction. What am I missing on this picture that I need for RM move Q? The register to memory move. What is missing from this picture that we're going to need to implement that? And one way to think about this systematically is one thing we can think about is I have some muxes here. Do these have a sensible choice? Like, can we choose something that makes sense for each of them? Another thing to think about is what does the instruction do, and think of what wires actually do that operation, and if you can't find one, maybe we need to add a wire. And this instruction reads a register and writes it to memory. So what are we missing to implement this instruction, or do we have everything we need already and we just need to set up the muxes appropriately and we'll have RMoveQ implemented? We just change this box labeled convert opcode. Yeah.
There's no wire to that end.
Yeah, so we need to write a value to memory, and that means we need to specify a value to memory. We're specifying an address. We actually need to write a value. So where should that come from? Yeah, so the value we just read from register A, that should go to our data. Anything else we're missing? So we have to pass the address we want to write to. So where does that go? Register a source B. Address in, and we also take the displacement. And it turns out we already have this here. And the reason why is because it's the same as mRemove queue. So we got that for free, just because our instructions happen to be similar, which is not a coincidence that our textbook authors designed it that way. Yeah?
Would you need some sort of write-enable on the register file?
So we need some sort of write-enable on the register file. So what's the problem you're seeing?
Whatever gets put out, the data out, get written to the...
Yeah, so your complaint is that this wire here has some value. It's either the value of register source register A, the value of the immediate, or whatever memory is outputting, which is going to be, you know, it's not, wires can't be blank, they are 0 or 1, so there's some value here, and we're writing to some register. And you're complaining, we shouldn't be doing that, we should have some write enable. And we don't have a write enable input in our register file, but we do have something that acts very similar. Does anyone remember what it was? There was something special about a particular register. Yeah. Yeah, so register 15 gets ignored, and its precise purpose is to act as a write enable. So the most straightforward solution would be that we want an option to take in 15 and send that to our destination register number, and that will make the value we're writing be ignored. And that's typically what you do. Technically, there's another option where you could observe that this line is source A, and you could write register A into register A. You could copy register A to itself, which would work too, but probably isn't what you'll actually implement when we have assignments, because that's not very intuitive. So instead, you'll just add a 15 input to that mux and say, we're going to write to register 15, and it doesn't matter what's on the value input, it's going to not do anything. And that's exactly what we want to do for this instruction. We don't want to change our register. So is there anything else anyone thinks we're missing? So how about our PC mux? Do we need to change anything there? Thinks yes, who thinks no? So some votes for no. Anyone want to explain why not? Did you think for meant plus what? Which is, so plus 10? Yes, so we want to go forward 10 bytes. It's exactly the same length as iRemoveQ, so you can do the same thing as iRemoveQ. And it turns out that I think is all we need here. So we'll have that. Well, there's one more thing that we missed. So we talked about a write enable for the register file. We also need that for the data memory. Because otherwise, what's going to happen in the iRemoveQ? If iRemoveQ is running, then, here we're going to have on this wire, on iRemoveQ is running, so let's say we're running, iRemoveQ of 1 to R8. So in that case, this wire here will have the value 1, this wire here we'll have the value 0 because we're reading from register 15. And this wire here will have whatever the value of our 8's value. So we'll be inputting an address, which is our 8 plus 1, and a value, which is 0. And if we don't do anything, we're going to write 0 to a memory location. If this were acted the same, if this iRemoveQ was working the same as our move queue. So we need this write enable, just gonna to make sure that we don't actually write to memory when we're not doing a write to memory instruction. Questions about that? Yeah. So the question is, when write is enabled, will we see anything out of data out? In the version you'll be using in the simulator, I think it will be, it's just zero. Real processors might do all sorts of things, but one of the things they're not going to do is just leave the wire floating. Because electronic circuits don't like it when you have wires with indeterminate values. Okay, so this is our move circuit. So let's go through just what happens just to make sure everything is clear. So here I have an RR move queue. So we read a value from the instruction memory and we get the first byte is 20, the second byte is 89. We also get a bunch of other bytes that we don't care about, but they're on this wire here. We have our 20 and our 89. Our 20 goes to this box here, which figures out how to set up our muxes and our write enable signal. And we also have our second byte where we have our two register numbers. So we get register number 8 and register number 9 as our inputs to our register file. We read from register 8. If we get that value on this line, we've selected the top mux input to go to this output here. So we're sending the value of register 8 into this register file here. And at the same time, this corresponding destination input, we're sending register number 9. So when the rising edge of the clock happens, the register file looks at its input. It says, okay, I have this value and I have register number 9. I'm gonna put that value in register number 9 and then I'm gonna move on. And that's what's going to happen at the rising edge of the clock after we set up all the signals like this. We also need to choose the next PC, which we're going to increment by 2, because this is a 2-byte instruction. We're going to do that by choosing the top end of this mux. So questions? What's going on here? And we have IRMoveQ. So in IRMoveQ, we get a source register number, which happens to be this 15 in the instruction. So you read from register 15, get a 0. It doesn't matter because we don't use it. We take our immediate, which we just got from the instruction memory, and send it through the mux as our input, along with register number 8, our destination. Then we have RM move queue. So here, we're sending register 15 as our destination because we don't want to write anything, don't want to worry about this mux. And we take our immediate plus our 9, which we took read by sending 9 into the register file, so we got the value of our 9 out. We add those together, that's our address. We also take the value of our 8, send that as our data input, and we set the write enable signal to true, so this is going to be 1 for this instruction. For all the others, it's 0. And then, you know, we don't care about this output because we aren't writing there. And we also need to increment our PC by 10 since it's a 10-byte instruction. Questions? What's going on here? And the remaining instruction is MRMoveQ. It turns out that our address calculation is exactly the same, with R9 coming from exactly the same place. And then we have R8, or that should be, yep. This should be R9, R8, because I know what is what in the instruction. So we have R9 goes into source B. We get the value of R9, which we use to compute our address. And we have R8, which we read. and we send as our data input, but here we're not writing, we're reading, so write enable is 0, and we actually get the value in memory at that location out. And we don't write to memory because it's not the instruction where we wanted to do that, and we properly set the write enables. So any questions about any of these sort of walkthroughs? Yes? Yes. So the question is, we select whether we do +2 or +10 based on the opcode. Where is that encoded? So what we're saying is that this piece of circuitry here has hard-coded in it the logic that we're going to take 2 and we're going to choose the first option 0 of the mux, and we're going to take anything else and choose option 1 of the mux. So it's just some hard-coded logic that has the opcodes baked into it to know what to do. That would work for this. Like, I haven't told you, like, what if we supply opcode 1 to this processor? I haven't told you what it does, and we don't have anything reasonable to do. So, you know, who knows what, you know, the implementation would do for that. Other questions? Okay, so we've been building circuits with pictures. So we have these pictures, we have to show the components with pictures, and that's a fine way to describe hardware. It's very nice to look at, and you can figure out what's going on by just tracing lines. It's pretty intuitive. So that's a fine way to describe pictures. And you might say, okay, let's just design our processor that way. We'll just take out some graph paper, or we'll take out a computer program that's the equivalent of graph paper, and we'll just make a processor on it. We can just do that. And that's a reasonable choice. And there are like real tools for making circuits which work by drawing things, that you draw things on a computer and that turns into a description that you actually build. It's a real thing that exists. There are commercial tools that where you draw a circuit with pictures, sort of like the pictures we're showing here, and you make everything very precise so you can actually build that. These are sometimes called schematic capture tools because you make a schematic and the tool captures it. And these exist. They actually are very uncommon to see used for processors. They're used for other different types of circuits, but they're generally not considered a good choice for processors, even though they could be used to build them. And some of you may have used tools like this. So if you've used Logisim and DLD, that's a tool of this sort. That's an educational one, but there are full-fledged commercial tools that have all the bells and whistles you need to actually do stuff. But people don't like this for building processors. They consider it too hard. So typically, they use something else. And we're going to talk about our form of the something else, which is going to be sort of an educational version that's similar to the real types of tools people would use to build processors. And this is a hardware description language, basically a programming language for hardware. So here, we're going to write some program, typically in text. And something's going to compile that into a description of how do I actually build this processor. So something like put the transistors here and here and here and here and connect them like this and this. That's what our compiler for this programming language is going to produce instead of assembly. And like a programming language, we're going to abstract away all these details we don't really care about. Like, we're not going to worry about how we build arithmetic operations from gates. Like, that's going to be supported in the compiler most of the time. We're not going to worry about building registers. We'll just have a way of saying, give me a register, and our compiler will take care of, I'll make a register for you. We're not going to worry about, here, how do I design a memory? We're just going to say, I want a memory of this size. Like, give me it. These are things that these sorts of languages do, you know, to make things more convenient. And similarly, how do I build a mux? We aren't going to worry about how do I construct a mux from gates. We're just going to say, I want a mux, and they're going to have the logic to say, okay, you want a mux that does this, here's the gates for that, because we can automate that sort of thing most of the time. So people in these sorts of languages usually don't deal with these details. And we're not going to deal with them. We're going to give you a language where you don't deal with those details, because that's not what this course is about. We're about making processors, not about churning, building arithmetic operations from gates, or building registers, or building muxes. So questions on this idea here of abstraction. So we're going to use a particular tool that is built just for this course called HCLRS. This tool, since it's built for this course, makes some assumptions. In particular, it assumes you're always making a processor. So it's not a general circuit design tool. It also assumes you're always making a 186 processor. So it's really not a general circuit design tool. It's based on our books HCL, which you may have read if you actually did the reading. It's a bit different, mostly in ways which should be better. Our books HCL is a little inflexible. This gives you more options. So hopefully is more convenient to use. Okay. So I'm going to start by looking at, let's take a simple processor and let's build it in this, not with pictures anymore, but in this text-based language that our tool is going to expect. So here's the processor I'm going to be building. So I'm going to have a program counter register, which I'll call BPC, like this. You'll see why later. Then I'll take the output of that, add one every time, and increment it. And you know, I'm going to read all my instructions, but this is a CPU that only executes NOPs. I'm going to assume every instruction is a NOP. So I'm just going to read the instruction memory and then ignore it. Okay. So one thing we need is we have this PC, the PC register, and we need to actually declare that. And the syntax for that in HCLRS looks something like this. So your first question is probably, what is this PF? What is that? So every register or set of registers, we have to specify what are the inputs and the outputs. So we have the output of this register. We're going to have to give a name. And that name is going to start with capital F. And the input to this register, we're going to have to give a name. And that's going to start with lowercase p. And the rule is that the names you choose for the sets of registers always are a lowercase letter, which is the input, and an uppercase letter, which is the output. You can choose any letters. I just chose P and F arbitrarily for this example. But you could have chosen P and P or anything else you want that's a letter. So I've declared this register. I've also said that this register is 64 bits. And that when the processor starts, its value is 0. So I need to implement this add one. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, I'm going to take the output of the register, which remember is the second letter, so capital F underscore the PC is the output of this register. I'm going to add one to it. Remember I said the abstraction means that we don't have to worry about how do you implement adding one. We're just going to write add one and have our compiler deal with turning that into an actual circuit. And then we're going to assign that to the input. And assignment means we're connecting two wires together, that they're connected on our picture. That's that add one loop. Next, we have this thing where we're reading from the instruction memory. And the reason this is on this picture is that in HCLRS, because it's designed for building a processor that runs y86, the instruction memory is mandatory. You must use the instruction memory in every HCLRS file, or you'll get a compile error. And the instruction memory has an input called PC, just lowercase, which is why I didn't name this PC. and it has an output called i10bytes, which is 10 bytes read from the location specified by CC within the same cycle. So here, I need to set its input. So I'm setting its input equal to the output of the register. And then I'm not using the i10bytes. It's set, but I'm not going to use it. So I'm not going to write any lines which reference it. So I don't care what the instruction actually is. I'm just ignoring it. So there's one more mandatory built-in component. So when you run your HTLRS program, we're going to have a simulator which runs it until it knows that you're done, but it needs some way to know, do I keep simulating or do I stop? So you have this stat signal, and here we're saying stat AOK, and that AOK means continue simulating. I'm not done, keep going. There's also a halt option, which is stop simulating, I'm done. And this controls whether our processor keeps running in the simulator or not. Okay, so any questions about this here? So I have a full source file. Let's run that in the actual thing you'll be getting. So when you download HTLRS, I should do, you'll unpack a tar file, you'll get some file with a directory with some files. The first thing you'll do is run make to build everything. I should do this. So you run make, and here I've prepared that NOP CPU I showed you earlier. So that's NOP CPU, and I need to run it, but remember we have an instruction memory. I need to say, what am I loading in the instruction memory? So I need a program to run. So I'm gonna I have prepared a program here. This Y86 program that runs a few NOPs and then does nothing. So there's my program. I need to turn it into something I can load. So the extension of something I can load is going to be .yo for Y86 object file. This is a .ys for Y86 assembly file. And there are two ways I can turn that into a .yo file. So one is YAS, which is the assembler, or you can also run the assembler with make. So I'll do, so I'll show both of these. So I can run make nops.yo, and it runs YAS. I could also just run that tools YAS command directly. And we could look at the .yo file. And unlike your object files from your compiler or your executables, this is readable. You can look at this to figure out what does it actually contain and figure out what's going on, maybe. So then we actually want to run that. So let's run this. So we have our NOP CPU, and we're going to supply this input file, so we'll just run it. And we see that it timed out after 9,999 cycles. We also see that for each cycle, we have the values of all the registers in the register file, even though we're not using that yet. We have the value of the program, the PC register we defined. For each cycle, we see it start goes, you know, at the end it was at hex 2070D, then 207E, then 207F. And we also have all the values in memory. So you can see, you can see that we have at address 00, we have 10 in hex. At address 01, we have another 10. And we have a blank spot at address 05. Blank spots, all memory you didn't set defaults to 0. And in fact, you can see that in addition to the values of memory and registers, we also know have at each point what we set the PC, that's the input to the instruction memory to, and what was loaded there, decoded as disassembled from YAD6 assembly. So we loaded all zeros because that's what's in our uninitialized memory, and this output is telling us we should have interpreted that as a halt, but apparently we didn't. And that's not surprising because we didn't implement halt in that HCL file I showed you. We didn't do anything with the instruction memory at all. So even though, you know, we know this is supposed to be a halt, that's not the processor we implemented, doesn't actually handle that case. So any questions about what you've seen of the output cube? Okay, so one thing we might want to do then is let's actually implement halt. So we want to add a mux, and we want to change the stat to be that sometimes we'll set the stat to HLT. We also have this third stat that you'll be using, which is invalid instruction. So the question is, what's the syntax to implement that mux? What does it look like? And HCRLs, this is what the book calls a case expression. So we have an open square brace followed by condition, colon, value, semicolon, with a bunch of conditions, and they're evaluated in order. So here, if x is 5, we say, is x equal to 5? Yes, we're giving 1. We don't care that x is also greater than 2. We're going to take the first thing which matches. Similarly, if x is 6, we say, is 6 equal to 5? No. Is 6 and 0 or 6? Yes, we're going to give 2. We don't care that 6 is also greater than 2. If x is 3, we're going to say, is 3 equal to 5? No. Is 3 and 0 or 6? No. Is 3 greater than 2? Yep, we're going to give 3. And same thing if x is 4, and so on. So they're evaluated in order. This turns out to be a lot more convenient for coding things up. That's how they work. Note that we have a default case here. So 1 is always true, and those are going to be mandatory for us. We're going to have a default case on every single thing, even if you think there's no way of using it. Okay. So this tells us basically how we're going to want to write our mux. So we're going to say something like stat equals if the opcode is 0, we want to halt. If the opcode is 1, then we want to keep going because this is a NOP. And otherwise, we have an invalid instruction. And stat ins will act like halt, but it will give a different message. And this will properly stop our simulator. But we have a problem. How do we can't actually write opcode, because that's not an actual signal unless we define it. So how do we figure out what the opcode is? How do we extract that piece of the instruction memory output, which remember was i10 bytes, as you might guess. i10 bytes is 10 bytes. And we don't actually want to compare 10 bytes to 0 and 10 bytes to 1. We only want to compare the first, the most significant 4 bits of the first byte. So now we want to do this extract operation. We're here. We have, i10 bytes, and we want to get, we have 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. So fortunately, we have an operation for subsetting bits from a value. And the syntax looks like this. If we want to get bits 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, we say value 2, dot, dot, 9. So it's inclusive of the first bit number and exclusive of the last. Now to do this means we have to have some way of numbering bits within a value. And the convention we've chosen is that the least significant bit is 0, and then next bit is 1, and so on, all the way up to the most significant bit, which has the highest number. So that means that we take our instruction memory output. So we have a NOP, so we have a 1, 0 as our first byte, 0. We have some other stuff in byte 1, some other stuff. And our output, we're treating as a little endian number, because we always use little endian in this class. So our byte 2 all the way up to byte 9. So our i10 bytes takes all of these and interprets at a little endian number. So the number is our byte 9, then our byte 8, then byte 1, and byte 0. And the part we want is here. So we took 10 bytes of memory. And byte 0 is least significant. 0 is the least significant part. And that's because we're doing little endian, lowest address, least significant. So it ends up that here is at bit 0, and here is bit 8. And all the way up here is going to be where bit 79 would be. So this people generally find very confusing. So we have multiple bytes in memory, and the way we've written out instructions so far, we always write the lowest numbered byte leftmost, but within each byte we write the most significant part first. So that's confusing compared to the order in which we load things as a little endian number. As a little endian number, the lowest byte is the least significant part, which, if I'm writing it as we do, like a hexadecimal constant, goes at the right end. But the bytes, we don't reorder the bits within a byte, and we've been writing the bits within each byte, the nibbles within each byte, in order. So when we wrote 1, 0, we meant that 0 was the least significant part of that byte. So our bit 0 here is in fact the least significant part, the bottom part of that byte that the opcode contains, and the part we want is actually bits 4 through 8. I can go through another example here, because this is using. So let's say we have push RBX. If we look up in our table of Y86 encodings, we find out push has an opcode part of A, hexadecimal A, 10, and then you have no condition code or function code, so we have an F there for 15, and that's our first byte. So our first byte is OXAF memory, and our second byte is OX2F. So this is the first byte in memory is AF, the second byte in memory is 2F. When we turn that into a little endian number, what we're saying is that this is the least significant part. So it's the least significant bit is the least significant bit of this least significant part. And so when we're taking this as a 2-byte little endian number, that goes as a chunk at the end of that number. And then the second byte goes more significant than it as a chunk in the same order it appears in the byte. We don't reorder things within the byte. We keep the bytes as is. They're the unit we store in memory. There's no ordering within a byte that we change. And so this means that if we want to get the opcode, this is going to be 4, and this is bit 7. So we'll do 4.8, because remember, it's inclusive of 4, exclusive of 8. And if we wanted to get this register number here, we'd say this is going to be 8. We'll do 12.16 to get that RA. Not 8.12, that would be RB. That would be RB, even though it's a lower bit number. So questions about this? Yeah. So is this just because the way they've been writing it is different? Yes. Unfortunately, it's rather awkward to write it in the other way. So like, this is how we've been writing it. If we wanted it to like be everything lined up the way you expected, we need to like put this byte 0 all the way at the end for everything, and then still have variable length instructions. That's a very awkward diagram, and that's probably why the textbook doesn't do that. Because we have to like have this picture look like we have this, and then this for our move queue. And that's really awkward to see how we find the next instruction given that, compared to when we write the bytes left to right, like this. But yes, we could have written it in this sort of way, where we keep everything in order by writing 0, 1, 2, 3, like so on, and have a whole instruction table like that, which would possibly avoid this confusion. But that's not what our textbook did, and that table has the disadvantage of it being a little more awkward to figure out how it deals with memory addresses. So, other questions? So, what this means is that if you want to get the first byte, that's bits 0 through 7, so if you want to extract it at 0.8, you'll ask for bits 0 through 4, 0.4, to get the least 4 significant bits of that, which is going to be the condition code information or the function code information for opq. You'll ask for the most significant 4 bits of that, bits 4 through 8, to get the opcode, which is what you're going to probably use most often. And similarly, when we want to get RA, that's the most significant bits of the second byte, so it's 12 through 16, not 8 through 12. Bits 8 through 12 is the least significant bits of the second byte, which is where RB is. So, any questions about this? I'm spending so much time in this because it causes all sorts of mistakes where people select RB instead of RA, then weird things happen. Yeah.
So the first digit is inclusive of the last digit.
Yes, that is the rule here. So you can do 0 through 4 or 4 through 8. So here we'll do 4 to 8 to select the actual opcode. So here, now that we know how to select the opcode part, we'll say if the opcode is not, and we have this convenient predefined constants. Because this tool is built just for making Y86 processors, we predefined a constant NOP and a constant HALT, which is 1 and 0 respectively, the opcodes, so you don't actually need to memorize all the opcodes or look them up and type them in your code. So we just have these conditions on the mux where we take that value and compare it up. And we can actually run this. So I have my CPU prepared that implements that, and I can run it on the same file we had earlier. And if we look at the execution here, we start by loading from address 0, we load a NOP instruction. So what we should do is we should increment the PC, and we can see that that in fact does happen. PC becomes 1, we load a NOP instruction. NOP instruction from address 1 instead of 0, then we load 1 from address 2, then 1 from address 3. And eventually, we get to our NOP instruction at address 4. We had 5 NOPs in the input file, and we load from address 5, and we get zeros because that's after initialized memory. Anything that's not initialized with 0 happens that 0 is a halt, conveniently. So even though I forgot to write a halt in that file, we still read a halt because we read uninitialized memory. And now we correctly interpret it, and it says we halted here after 6 cycles. It's the same one I used earlier, so I can take a look at it here. So the same one I used before, which I made by running make nops.yo after creating this file. It's just the actual assembly. So, yeah, I can see that works. So let's move on to simulating some of our processors we've seen before. We'll start with our NOP and jump processor. So here we have we need to set the status, which we had a MUX for. We also need to set our next value of the PC conditionally based on our MUX. And I have values I want to use a lot of times. So for example, I want to use the opcode, you know, those 4 bits to determine whether, you know, my status is keep going or halt or invalid instruction. And I want to use it to determine whether the next value for my program counter is add 1 or use the destination from the jump. And I can define what are called wires, which you can think of as basically equivalent to variables, just giving a name for a quantity. So I have one here called iCode, and I'm saying it's 4 bits long. And I'm assigning it a 4-bit value, which is 4 bits 4 through 8. And now I don't need to type iCode 4.8 over again. I can just, I 10 bytes 4.8, I can just type iCode every time and reuse that value. And similarly, I have a dest here, and dest I'm saying bits 8 through 72, which is where my constant address that the jump target is. So I just give a name for that so it's easier to read this code here. So we have our dest, put down there, so. I also have val p, which I'm using as something to store what I just eventually assign to the PC input. So P the PC, lowercase p because of the p there, is val p, which is equal to this MUX calculation. So I can have these extra variables. You might say, why did you use val p? That's a bad name. That's the name the textbook uses. That's why I'm using it here. One thing to note is that since we're required to have default values in muxes, I've used my default value is this bad, bad, bad. That's just so when I accidentally used that in the middle of my processor running, I could say, oh, I probably used that default case, rather than saying, oh, why is this zero? Or something like that. I made sure I chose a value which wouldn't make any sense, so it would be pretty obvious if I start executing instructions at bad, 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 instead of a location I expect. So let's run this CPU. So I have a copy of the CPU here, and I need a file to run. So I've prepared an assembly file here. So here's my assembly file. I knock, jump to C, jump to B, D, jump to B, and so on. And I can make this into a .yo file, turns YIS, and I can look at that YO file, and I can see that my assembler helpfully figured out the addresses to put in everywhere. And we have our actual thing that's ready to load with all the machine code. And I can run this. So I can take not jump cpu.hcl, run it on that. And if I look through this instruction trace, I see that we first load the NOP at address 0, and then we set PC to 1, load the jump to address 13, and then we set the PC to address 13, and we load a jump to address A, then we set the PC to A, load a jump to address 1C, then we load from 1C a NOP, we go to 1D, load another NOP, and then we go to 1E, incrementing load a halt, and that's where we finish off. And after 7 cycles, we end up halting. So we can also compare this to our textbook's implementation. So our textbook authors have supplied a reference implementation of Y86 as a simulator that's standalone called YIS, and I can run this on this notjump.yo, and it tells me it also took 7 steps, so that seems good, and it halted, and there were no changes to registers or memory, which makes sense because I didn't do anything with registers or writing memory. And that also the zero flag was 1 and the sign flag was 0. So HTLRS has some options which are convenient for debugging. So one of them is that in addition to looking at what instructions are loaded and the values of the PC and the values in memory, you can also pass the debug option and it will print out more information about what it's doing. So after each cycle, we print out what item bytes get set to, where we're reading, the full value, not just the disassembly. So you can see the full 80-bit number. And we also have a table of the values of every single wire we name. So destination, that wire had the value 13, which is good because that's the destination of the jump. So if you were worried that I'm going to the wrong place, this is what you might check. You might say, first, am I reading the right destination? And you can say, yeah. And you can look at, am I setting the input to the PC register correctly? And you could say, okay, that's little p underscore the PC, and yep, that's set to 13. And you could look at all these signals to figure out what's going on. That's an alphabetical table for after every cycle. What the values were just before the rising edge of the clock. And if you have all this output, one thing you can do is you can save it to a text file by redirecting this to a file and then viewing that file in some text editor. There's also an option called interactive or dash I, which will ask you to press enter after every cycle. So if you just want to do the equivalent of single stepping, this will work. So it's saying, here's the values at the end of the first cycle. I'm ready to do the writes. You press enter. It actually does them and moves on to the next cycle. And you might say, well, it's outputting entirely too much. I just want to know how many cycles it takes and what, you know, that everything worked out fine in the end. So there's a quiet option, which will just show you the last state. And I guess I'd also note, I showed you the interactive option with debug. You can also use it without if you want. You want less output. So any questions about any of these, any of the things I showed you here? Yes?
Where is the documentation located for all the flags?
So there's a write-up on the website linked at the top of the website as HTLRS. For the flags in particular, I mean, if you type dash dash help or just nothing, it will give you a quick listing of all the flags, including some I haven't talked about. I guess the most notable one is there's a check flag, which will just say, does this file have correct syntax without running it? Yeah, I'm just that. Yes, so if I adjust this to have some sort of syntax error, it will give me an error about it. And hopefully a useful one. Okay. So I'd like to go over briefly the most important differences from what we have and what the book has. So one difference is you saw wire. The book uses bool or int. We just have one name for everything, and you just specify the number of bits it is, and that's how we distinguish. So you know, wire, one-bit wires are bools. We don't have distinguish. The book uses particular names, and in the book's implementation of HCL, students needed to use those names. Like, they have BELC, students need to use that. We don't have that requirement. You can define all your own signals. If you don't like the book's names, which would be very reasonable, you can use your own, or you can just duplicate the book's names. You can add new wires, and so on. As I mentioned earlier, Muxis needed a default case. This is not required by the book. You can just put a dummy value. Just make it so it's something that's obvious. If you think the default case should never happen, make sure when you're reading the debug output, you'll see something that tells you, oh, maybe it can. Maybe I forgot one of the instructions or something like that. Also, in the book's HCL that their students used, they provided an ALU and just had the students use it. We're going to have you just write your own. You're just going to write a mux with the arithmetic expressions and deal with it that way. We're not going to worry about the details of implementing an actually good ALU because we're doing everything with the simulator. So any questions about these differences or any differences I may have forgotten? Okay. So let's talk about features in HTLRS more systematically, and we'll probably finish this up next time. So one thing I showed you earlier was register banks. So the general syntax for register banks is that you have, this is a set of registers, which we'll call register bank, is that you have register, you have the input letter, which must be lowercase and a letter, and the output letter, which must be uppercase. And we create a signal, which is the input letter underscore for each register and the output letter underscore for each register. The input letter is the input signal, the output is the output signal. Each register has a width, which is not optional. You have to specify a width in bits for the register and a default value, which most notably will be the initial value when the processor starts up. There are some other signals for registers, stall and bubble, which we'll talk about later when we talk about pipelining. You won't be using them right now, but they exist and you might see them referenced in some documentation. So any questions about register banks? The question is this two different registers foo and bar that each have the same input and output? So these are two different registers and they have their own input and their own output. So foo's input is x foo, bar's input is x bar. And there are sort of independent input and output signals that you can set to completely different things from completely different places. They're grouped together. The idea is that later on, we'll have a reason to have more registers in the program counter, and it turns out we will want groups of related registers, and we'll have a very good reason for that, and that's why the syntax looks like this. Okay, good question. Other questions? So the question is Linux register more registers than YAD6? So this is not how we'll actually implement, it turns out, RAX, RBX, and so on. We'll be different. We'll have a register file we will supply for you, which we'll talk about next time. But you can define an arbitrary number of registers for whatever you want to do. Right now, it doesn't seem like you have very much to do because all we can think of is we need a program counter and a sign flag and a zero flag. So that's three. So you don't have much reason to have more than that. But later on, we're going to have reason to have, you'll probably be writing code where you'll have order like 30-ish registers in it, where it will make more sense. But for right now, we have the PC and the condition codes. The condition codes are a reason why you might want to have multiple registers together. You think about zero flag and sign flag, be good to have them together in your code. Okay, so next thing I'd like to talk about is wires. We saw wire declarations as convenience. In HTLRS, anything that can accept or produce a signal we call a wire. So the input to the built-in instruction memory, PC, that's a wire. The output, i10 bytes, that's a wire. Wires hold a signal which can be, any number of bits wide. And we can declare new wires, or there's some implicit ones. So for example, when we make a register that defines some wires, x_foo was a wire with a particular width, but we didn't declare it with wire, we declared it by making the register that needed that input wire signal. And generally, for any type of wire, you can set wire name equal to something to connect something to that wire. You can connect exactly once to a wire. You can't have two values being fed into a wire because we don't know what to do with that. And you can use the value of a wire multiple times. So the assignment here is connecting two wires. It's not assignment like we're used to in C. In particular, order doesn't matter. So these two things, so here you might say, oh, we're taking val p and then we're assigning a new val p. That's not what this does. Every cycle, we do everything once. And so what this is saying is we're taking val p and you need to look for what val p is this cycle. And you look down here and you find out it's the PC plus one. And it's exactly the same effect as here where we say we're taking val p, we look for what val p is this cycle, we look in the whole program, we find out, oh, it's the PC plus one, that's the value. It's the same in both cases, the order doesn't matter. We just look for where is it assigned, we take the value we have this cycle, and that's what we use. Yes?
But the order of, like, whether it's on the left or the right of
Yes, so the location in the assignment does matter, yes. But the order of assignments in the file is not relevant to semantics. When we see the wire name, we just look for where is it set by being on the left side of an equal. And we just take, substitute in that value as it's computed from this cycle when meeting with the current value of the PC, for example. The order doesn't matter. Either the wire is connected or it's not. We don't like have old versus new value. It's just connected or it's not. It's connected to something, we take that value as it exists in this cycle. So wires have another constraint, which is wires have widths. You declare them with widths, and all the wires we're going to deal with have a width. And if you try to take a wire and change its width, you can't do that. So if I have a 64-bit wire, I can't assign a 32-bit wire to it. Can't connect them, they're disagreeing with, that's an error. If I want to do something like that, I need to explicitly say what I'm getting. So for example, I want to assign this 64-bit value to a 32-bit thing, I can say explicitly, I want the first 32 bits, and that's fine. But I can't just have different widths, connect them to each other, where the HCLRS is just going to say, I don't know what to do with that. It's not going to try to guess that you want to truncate the value. It's not going to try to guess you want to add zeros. It's just going to say, no, you can't do that. Okay. So any questions on that? This notion of width. Okay. So one note about width. So I told you that wires have width. Constants also have widths sometimes. So binary constants have a width. So if you have a binary constant, you can only assign it to a wire which matches the number of bits you've written. Other types of constants don't have a width, which means that you can assign them to any size wire and we'll just deal with it, even if that means dropping some of the bits. And most of the built-in constants have widths. So to make sure, you use them with the appropriate width wire. Sorry? Oh, yes, I should show to be consistent with the other section. Let's do here. And if you want to know what all the constants are, this is, as I mentioned, the documentation. If you click HCLRS up here, and if you go down here, we just show you, here are all the constants that are defined. And what we actually do is we just take this code here and prefix it before your program. That defines, so stat AOK has to have this value, and it's this wide, and so on. And we also have halt, nop, r, move q. These are predefined constants. You don't have to use them, but it's probably convenient that we've already written down a constant that you can use for, all the opcodes. Yes. So the question is, what about a small wire to big wire? If you don't do anything, it's an error. Compile error. If you want to send a small wire to a big wire and add zeros, there is a way of doing that. It is documented in that write-up. I have never seen anyone need to do that. Okay, and next time we'll pick up and point out about the other components we need, like register files and memory. We'll talk about what those look like and finish up to being able to actually build more complete processors.